All right, welcome to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Heintzman. We do not yet have a quorum. Once we do, I will move House File 2012. Representative Heintzman, I understand you have some testifiers. Let's go immediately to the testifiers, and then we will establish a quorum, move the bill and the amendment. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Glenn Anderson, and I live in Duluth, Minnesota, but I work at Northern Pines Mental Health Center over in the Brainerd area, which serves six counties up in central Minnesota. And I'm here to testify about this bill. There are four programs that this bill would continue funding that will put funds available to expand and strengthen our community-based services, especially supportive housing, assertive community treatment, respite care, and crisis services. And all of these are examples of the situation that we're in, which is we don't have a broken mental health system. We have a system that's being built, under construction. And I'm here to testify about this because my mental health center run several of these programs up in the Brainerd area, and I can testify from personal experience to their huge effectiveness, both in terms of the lives of people with mental illness, but also in terms of their effectiveness in terms of cost savings. For example, our sort of community treatment team serves about 85 people at any given time. And a study was done of the 27 ACT teams in the state to see what happened to hospitalization rates for ACT clients before they were on the ACT team and after they were on the ACT team. And the reduction in a need for hospitalization during a one-year study more than paid for the entire cost of all 27 ACT teams, just in terms of the savings in hospital costs, not to mention what that does for freeing up bed space for other people. Likewise, our crisis program, we have a mobile crisis outreach program that last year served in a face-to-face. We went to where the crisis was, more than 2,000 people. And of the people that we saw in the emergency department, in one of our seven emergency departments in our hospitals in our region, 75% of the people did not get hospitalized because crisis services showed up with an alternative to being hospitalized. And so we kept three-quarters of the people from our region out of those beds because they didn't really need to be in the hospital, but they would have been in the hospital if the crisis services hadn't been available to provide them with a viable opportunity to stay out of the hospital. And the same is true of supportive housing and respite care. These are programs that can keep people from needing to be in the hospital or in jail or in all of the other places where people with mental illness aren't going to be well served. This is really important stuff for our continued construction of the mental health system.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We do appreciate you coming down on your testimony, and we do now have a quorum. I will officially call the meeting to order. Would Representative Zerwas move approval of the minutes for March 8, 2017? Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 8, 2017, all say aye. Those five, no. The minutes are adopted. I will move House File 2012. Representative Heintzman, I will also, I will move House File 2012 be laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. The bill is now officially before us, and to our next testifier, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Anderson, and I'm from Champlin. And I am here on behalf of my son, who suffers from mental illness. On December 28, 2012, my son walked into my room one night and demanded I tell him what I've been keeping secret from him. He demanded that I admit that a friend of mine was physically abusing me. Of course, that wasn't true. I was mortified beyond belief. By the next day, his behavior had become so erratic that I had to bring him to the hospital. I know now that he was having his first episode of psychosis. He was home by day six with 30 days of meds and several pamphlets with crisis intervention phone numbers. The doctors explained very little and gave me no idea of what to expect. I remember being astonished when they told me a discharge. I hope you don't need to come back. I was mortified at that comment. I had no idea what was coming. I spent a year and a half frantically worrying about my son, wondering what was happening to him and how I could help. I literally felt like I was watching a slow-motion train wreck. Sometimes I cried so hard, I found myself on the floor curled up in a ball. Within 2 months of his first hospital discharge, I received the most devastating phone call of my life. It was truly my darkest hour. His counselor called me and told me she was sure he had schizophrenia. I remember shrieking in fear, driving in the pouring rain, trying to keep my car on the road. I will always remember that evening, driving home on the 610 bridge, with my only thought being, my life is over, there's no way I can handle this. Life went on with the new normal until my son had his second episode of psychosis. There was a night and day difference between his first episode and his second episode. 6 days after his first episode, he was extremely stable and coping very well. 10 days after his second episode, I got a call that he was being discharged and he was nowhere near being stable. As I walked in the door when I brought him home after his second episode, he said angrily, "Mom, people are still messing with me after all I've been through." They had released him while he was still in psychosis. It took him almost 6 months to stabilize after his second episode, and he continues to hear voices even with the medicine. He needs a great deal of support right now, and he isn't getting it. When I learned about ACT teams, I knew this is what he needed, but it took me researching on my own to find the options available. He's on a waiting list for an ACT team, but they have no idea how long that wait will be. He needs this intensive community support now. I don't want him to have another episode and be hospitalized. If he actually would have had more help after the first episode, I truly believe there would have been a different outcome. I'm trying to make my darkest hours the most defining moments of my life. I'm trying to make good out of bad. I'm here to light a path for others when I had none. I'm a voice for mental illness as I sit before you today. Please increase funding for these vital mental health programs.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. We appreciate your testimony. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to say I'm happy to be a co-author on the bill with Representative Heinzman. I have a trivia question, though, for the committee. What is the largest concentration of mentally ill people in the United States? Cook County Jail in Chicago. Number two is the L.A. County Jail. This funding is desperately needed, and there are far too many of mentally ill people in the jail. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Next testifier, Representative Heinzman.
Unfortunately, our third testifier was not able to attend, so we are ready for questions.
All right. Questions for Representative Heinzman.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. There is an oral amendment that we would like to move.
All right.
My testifier will help us through the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sue Aberholding, now in Minnesota. It's on page 2, line 5. And just inserting this as an ongoing appropriation so that it matches the fiscal note.
I don't have the fiscal note in my packet. distributed. Okay, Ms. Adger-Holden, I don't have it, so I'm not able to make that change at this time.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. We can go back to questions.
All right. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask about the cost effectiveness of this. I saw it says dollar invested and $3.90 in benefits, and if somebody could just talk about kind of where those benefits flow and how. I'm particularly interested in that, Mr. Chair.
There was a study done in Hennepin County, I think is the handout that you have in front of you, but there have been several other studies that look at the fiscal. It's kind of hard to monetize things like mental health, but you can easily see in crisis programs if the crisis can be intervened in quickly enough to avert an expensive hospitalization that would otherwise be unnecessary if there was an alternative, you can put a price to that. And that was what I was kind of referring to when I talked about the ACT team. There was a study there. Now, the savings in the ACT teams more than covers the entire cost of all of the ACT teams, but it's about a $300% return on investment in terms of cost savings in crisis services. The thing is, of course, is that who saves the money is money doesn't get spent in other less effective ways and in other programs, but there's also the secondary effect of if those beds are freed up, then the people who really need to be in the hospital get to be in the hospital because the program, doesn't clog up with folks who don't need to be in the hospital if there's an alternative.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I'm particularly interested in the breakdown of the 390, and so if you have any kind of data or anything on that, if you could just send to me separately. I mean, certainly very supportive of this. It sounds like a wonderful use of funding, and I'm just particularly interested in that, kind of where it flows and how much it is and that kind of thing. I'd love to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions for Representative Heintzman? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was kind of startled by the return on investment that I just heard and how confidently you can say that it pays for itself. And that is such a great lesson to us as we are putting together the Health and Human Services budget. The way that, the savings are realized might not actually be in the Health and Human Services budget. It might be in criminal justice. It might be in other places, but it exists certainly. And as we push so hard for these kind of bright, shiny bottom lines, we aren't kind of looking to what the bigger impact is in terms of cost savings, which we can talk about. But we also heard a lot about the human suffering that we could help alleviate as well, and so it is yet one more reason why cutting HHS is going to be real dangerous in the coming years because we continue to talk about the crises that we're facing. And so thanks for bringing this forward, Representative Heintzman.
Other questions? Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Heintzman.
Great bill. Thank you.
House File 2012 is laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Heintzman moves House File 1258 be laid over for possible inclusion in our bill. We have the bill before us. There's an A1 amendment. Representative Heintzman moves the A1 amendment. Put it in the shape that he would like. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Heintzman to House File 1258 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to turn over the next portion to my testifier.
Welcome, Mr. Goodnow.
Thank you,
the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself, although you need no introduction, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here today representing Nystrom & Associates.
Nystrom & Associates provides mental health and chemical dependency services throughout the state of Minnesota. They operate from 11 different locations throughout the state and serve people in, I believe, 83 or 82 of the 87 counties in Minnesota over the last year. Over 50% of the people they serve statewide are on medical assistance, so they have a high, large stake in and a strong commitment to serving people with mental health needs. They have asked and have moved forward and support the Heisman bill, House File 1258 as amended, because it will equalize the rates that they get that are paid to other like type of facilities to theirs. They back in 2007, there was a large increase in mental health rates with the intent of increasing access to mental health services for lower-income Minnesotans. That increase only applied the higher reimbursement rate to mental health clinics and centers that are designated as essential community providers. Nystrom and others would be the same. They're a mental health center, but they can't meet the designation as an essential community provider because they're a for-profit entity rather than a not-for-profit. So with our commitment, we're looking for equalization of rates. We would expect that this would allow for the maintenance of the mental health infrastructure throughout the state of Minnesota and also be able to expand the access to services for people throughout the state. And we'd appreciate your support for the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Goodnow? Seeing no questions for Mr. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Heitzman. You know, essential community provider was designated for the nonprofits that traditionally have served the uninsured and those who are most heavily dependent on public programs. And, you know, we have had limited ability to give rate increases over the years. We've always regretted that. But when we've given it, it has been to those that are overburdened because they are serving primarily the uninsured and people who are dependent on public programs. And so I'd like to better understand why you think this for-profit provider deserves to be treated the same as the traditional nonprofits that we have supported with increased reimbursement and recognition of that open-door policy and the fact that they are nonprofit mission-based in terms of focusing on access.
Mr. Goodnow, Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think something to keep in mind in this is that there are more than one provider in numerous examples across the entire state, and with the need that is there, there needs to be the opportunity for folks to access that care where it can be found. And if this legislation is passed, it will help to resolve some of those access issues. And with If Mr. could expand on that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know and I've heard through this committee a number of concerns expressed about differential on rates and how that creates some perverse incentives. And right now, the rate increase that was provided in 2007 was a 23.7% rate increase. So there's that much of a difference between the rates between these providers. This isn't asking for rate increase just for Nystrom & Associates. It's would it be applied to all rural 29 facilities that would be for-profit in purpose. So there are a number of other providers that provide services, but the rural 29 is similar to the other rural 29s that are out there that are not-for-profit, that are central community providers. Nystrom serves, as an example, almost 47,000 unique individuals a year who are receiving mental health and chemical dependency services. Over half of those people are on medical assistance. And we serve people throughout the state of Minnesota, so we are part of the mental health infrastructure that we need to sustain. By having a 23% rate differential, you basically are perpetuating the need to continue to support those other providers that are doing and having an undue burden on medical assistance, because it will drive other providers away from being able to invest in the infrastructure needed to serve those people with mental illness. And so the equalization of the rates will help stabilize the overall community, take some of the pressure off those essential community providers, but also start building the whole infrastructure that we need around mental health services.
This isn't about us, nonprofit versus for-profit. It's about building up the mental health infrastructure throughout the state of Minnesota.
Representative Lofton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Goodnow and Representative Heinzman. I think the difference is a commitment to serve the uninsured, and I'm wondering if you could tell us or have any data on these for-profit entities, what percent of their patient load is the uninsured, because paying more higher rates for MA patients in those, the nonprofit essential community providers, was to, in recognition that they're stepping up to people who don't qualify for insurance and filling a gap that, that quite honestly, in most communities, no one else fills.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a 23% rate difference. And NYSTRM does not turn away people who come to them for needs. I can't speak for the other for-profit providers, but anybody who comes in, we serve. With the Minnesota's lower and decreasing uninsured rate, it's become an issue. My understanding is that in most cases, people don't come and receive services, even from the essential community providers, without some reimbursement at some level, even from the counties, because I know the counties feel an obligation to provide services to their folks. So all we're saying is there's plenty of needs out there. Let's invest in this infrastructure and build the needs across the board. This is a first step. This is where we've identified a need. I just want to make a note on the fiscal note. It's substantially, the corrected fiscal note is substantially less than the fiscal note that was distributed to the public. And I think it's a wise investment to move forward and invest in this way.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Heinzman or to Mr. Goodnow, the difference, as I understand, the essential community provider is there are some requirements in law that they cannot turn anyone away. They cannot. And that they must provide background services to support their client. So I think that's why we've attached additional reimbursement to those essential community providers, because we're asking them as a state to take on extra responsibility. So my question really for you, Representative Heisman, is are you open to extending that same commitment to this piece of legislation for the organizations that are wanting the additional reimbursement rate to match the essential community provider, should they also then accept the same level of responsibility from the state, and would you be open to that as an amendment to this legislation?
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, this seems to be a reoccurring question from committee to committee, and I think that you've asked a number of times. This particular issue, I think, rests on a couple of different things. Number one, we're first of all trying to make sure that people continue to have access. And the Essential Community Central Services in my town is, in the nonprofit side, is not enough to cover the need. We're working to expand that. That's number one. Number two, this is an area where Dyson Associates, as you've just heard, doesn't turn anybody away. That commitment has already been demonstrated, and in my mind, it seems very reasonable, especially considering the cost that we're looking at here, to look at connecting those two things and making sure that we are expanding access.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Heinzman. And this is the second time I've seen the legislation, so I'm glad to ask you the questions here in finance. If NYSTRM Associates don't turn any people away, then I don't understand how this would be a hardship to accept this same responsibility as other essential community providers have accepted. And we've asked them to do that to make sure that there's a safety net available. And I'm grateful that NYSTRM Associates won't turn people away and want to participate and be a part of the safety net as they are. I'm just asking or suggesting that it would be wise then to extend that same responsibility to them.
Representative, or Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Murphy, I actually asked Mr. Nystrom that very question because the complaint was Nystrom cannot, unless they go to a nonprofit status, could not become an essential community provider. And yes, they would be happy to abide by all the other rules related to an essential community provider, but they just won't be able to make the nonprofit status. So we're open to that. The one hesitancy I have about that is just the whole challenge we've had on the critical access dental program, where we've had the differential in the rates based on the number of people served on Medicaid. But if we would be, from our perspective, just speaking on behalf of Nystrom, we would be happy to work with you on that. I know that this bill covers more providers than just Nystrom.
Thank you.
Questions? Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Heinzman.
As the floor, it's a very good bill and appreciate support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. Mr. Goodnow, House File 1258, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, we have House File 1404, Representative Baker. Representative Baker, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1404 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Baker, I understand you got a couple testifiers.
I do.
And we will go to testifiers.
Mr. Chair, go right to testifiers. Or should I give a quick overview?
Very quick overview.
Just far too long, again, our mental health system has relied on a fail-first method. Typically, what we're finding is when folks have a first episode with a mental breakdown or a sign that there's going to be a problem, it usually ends up to be about 74 weeks, and we can do a lot of good things in between now and then. So with that, this bill, 1404, talks about the first psychotic episode, and I've got two regular testifiers ready to go, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go in whatever order you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abbott Holding, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just wanted to add that we have had state and federal funds be used. You appropriated money in 2015, and we were able to use 10% of our federal block grant. So we now have three psychotic first episode teams in Minnesota. They're all, one is located at the Hennepin County Medical Center, and two teams at the University of Minnesota Psychiatry Clinic in St. Louis Park. But what we need in Minnesota is eight of these programs. And we also need to make sure that when they're in rural Minnesota that we help with transportation and housing, because this is an outpatient program. And if you think about northwestern Minnesota, just the geographic area you would need to be able to have enough people having a first psychotic episode get there, we want Ronald McDonald homes, basically, around these programs so that people have a place to stay. The RAISE program, and I have a handout just explaining it, this is research-based. It's been funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. It really shows that while we don't yet know how to prevent schizophrenia from developing, we can prevent it from becoming disabling. Schizophrenia is one of the 10 most disabling conditions in the world, and so we want to make sure that we do a better job in terms of intervening. And at this point, I'd like you to hear from a parent.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Cynthia Cattell. I'm a resident of Golden Valley. I have a daughter with schizophrenia. Our daughter was an avid reader and writer, curious about absolutely everything she saw around her. She loved being outside, family hiking, horseback riding, and she was always willing to try new experiences. She did an ecology camp that was for college students when she was in high school. She was planning to go to college in Scotland. It had been accepted there. In 2009, shortly before her 19th birthday, she began to have frightening hallucinations. We walk regularly around Cedar Lake, and she would be looking around. She would be hearing things and seeing things that were terrifying for her. And soon she reported that she couldn't read, she couldn't write, she couldn't even watch TV programs. She could not concentrate or focus to do that. And she had to drop out of the university. She couldn't continue her coursework. She couldn't safely live by herself. And her life really came to a crashing halt. And we didn't know what to do. Her psychiatrist and the therapist that she had at that time tried to do things. They didn't have the training really they needed to deal with this illness, and she just didn't get better. After about 6 months and one hospitalization with suicide attempt. Someone luckily referred us to the University of Minnesota's first episode program, which was just beginning at that point. And it was a lifesaver, literally, for my daughter. She had a psychiatrist and a therapist who were actually trained to deal with people with this illness. And within about 6 months of her working in that program, we could see the daughter that we lost kind of slowly returning to us. She began to be able to interact with us again. The contact was also vitally important for my husband and myself. If you're faced with something like this, you just have nowhere to turn. And the first episode programs have very strong parent education programs. And so we could learn about the course of the disease, what we could expect, what could be done. And in addition, we've got this wonderful cohort of parents who were dealing with the same problem to whom we could talk. And that is also very, very important, so you don't just feel like you're sitting there on your own. It was critical. And, you know, now we're talking about 8 years later, 3 more suicide attempts and hospitalizations, so it's not been an easy task, but at this point, she's actually able to live alone by herself. We do have to do a fair amount of support. We do her medication management. We do a lot of the grocery shopping and providing meals, but she is living on her own. And she is able to make contacts herself in the larger community. She pet sits for friends. She's not able to work at this time. She's not able to go back to school, but she certainly hopes that she'll be able to do that. And, you know, we've seen a dramatic improvement with the appropriate care. And, you know, I have to say, if you've never had a child with a psychotic illness or a friend with a child with this illness, you just can't imagine what it's like. I mean, you're seeing your child suddenly stop dead in their progress through life. And it's difficult for them because they see all their friends going on. Their friends are graduating. You know, the friends are getting jobs. Their friends are finding partners. And they're stuck. They're just not able to move forward with their lives. And programs like this are invaluable in helping assure that these children are, and they're not children usually, they're young adults, but that they're actually able to have as productive and happy lives as possible. And it's just clear the earlier that you can intervene and get the appropriate treatment and wrapping that treatment around them, everything that they need, is really, really critical. And I really urge you to support this program. We really need to have more programs like this.
Thank you, Ms. Cattell, for your testimony and for your advocacy on behalf of your daughter and others. Questions for the testifiers? Anyone from the audience wish to testify on this bill? Ms. Abderholden and Representative Baker, any final thoughts?
Mr. Chair, members, we just need your help. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, House File 1404 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Baker, Ms. Abderholden, and Ms. Cattell. Next up, we have Representative Baker's House File 1177. And I will move House File 1177 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. There is an A1 amendment in the packet, an author's amendment that is technical in nature. I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Baker to 1177 as amended.
Thank you.
you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I bring to you a bill that we, in a county collaboration out in western Minnesota, were able to see the effects of this a number of years ago. And when disabled young folks challenged with some mental illnesses and such, when they're transitioning from youth into adult, this mentorship program has done wonders for many people out there and gives them a much better chance to be a very productive individual as they transition into adulthood. I know myself going through adolescence was a challenge on its own. Imagine if you have some other challenges that you're fighting. This program has been proven to work very, very well. Mr. Chair, I have two very good folks here to talk about this today that have seen this program work, and I would love to have you hear their story. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I have Ms. Rochelle Peterson and Becky Romas. Welcome to the committee. Please go in whatever order you'd like.
Thank you. My name is Becky Romas. I'm a parent as well as a retired psychiatric nurse. And I have a story about my son. We've heard some stories today. I think stories tell an impactful message. Eric was diagnosed very early on with mental health challenges. He was diagnosed at age 3. And we battled about 4 or 5 misdiagnoses before he was finally given the proper diagnosis at age 15 of Asperger's syndrome. Asperger's syndrome was now part of the autism spectrum disorder, and at that time, what that did for us was opened up doors so that we could get some idea of how we approach this. How do we give Eric the best that we can? How do we get him into the right educational setting so that he could learn? He didn't want to stay home. He wanted to go to college. He didn't want to be with his mother. He wanted to be out with friends. Another program came along, which we have a mental health collaborative in the Candela County area, 5-county area now, called Pact for Families. And at that time, they had a program that was a federal grant called Pride For, which was for transitional youth from the ages of 14 to 25. And what it did is help them bridge that gap between youth to adulthood. Now, any of you that have had children know that not all the time do your teenagers listen to you. So it's very helpful to have a coach-type idea, a coach-type setup, and with Eric it worked wonders. He learned how to apply for college, and he did apply for college and was accepted and completed a college. He applied for scholarships. He learned how to cook. He learned how to set up a living in his apartment. He became a taxpaying citizen, which would make my father very proud. He did very well, and for 2 years he was employed as a non-destructive testing technician out of Michigan, formed some work relationships, some family relationships. Those are all things that he was able to formulate directly related to the Pride For grant. Eric isn't with us anymore. He died 4 years ago. He died from leukemia. His whole course of leukemia was a matter of 6 months, and he fought the battle valiantly, and I think some of his resilience and spirit came from having to battle mental illness when he was younger. But he's up there, and he keeps telling me, Ma, these kids need help. Get on it. Do something. Give them some help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ramos. We appreciate your testimony and express our sympathy for the loss of your son. Also, we have Ms. Peters. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rochelle Peterson, and I'm the executive director at Pact for Families, which is a children's and mental health collaborative in central Minnesota, south central Minnesota. We heard from Ms. Ramos about her experience as a parent of a young person who utilizes the services in which we're proposing here today. Me, myself, I have worked 25 years in rural Minnesota in mental health capacities in various entities. I am new in my director role here, but I come with experience working in prevention, but mostly in response to mental health crisis issues. I can honestly say I'm in my position because I feel like prevention is really where our resources need to be at. My most recent position has been in the public defender's office, working as a social worker, working with mental health issues of those young people who are revolving doors that get caught in the system with mental health issues. In the handout that you have in front of you, there are some cost breakdowns of things, so we won't go through all of those. But I just want to talk about the rural challenges that we face in rural Minnesota when it comes to mental health. Our biggest obstacle is probably not having enough mental health practitioners. You hear about the ACT teams today. All of those things are rural barriers for us. When we make a referral for a youth, they may wait weeks or even months to get just that first initial appointment. They may have the option of going to a metro area to receive services, but you're talking possibly a two-hour drive for one-hour appointment. You're talking a whole entire missed day of school, perhaps, and a missed day of work for family members just for that one initial appointment. Often this becomes very unmanageable for folks, and then they just choose to opt out of services. So things build, and problems become more difficult. Rural Minnesotans, as we've heard already today, are maybe underinsured or not insured at all. Some of this is due to self-employed people not having access to insurance or small employers that don't offer insurance. So more rural Minnesotans utilize Medicaid, where the reimbursement rate is low. We've heard about that also today, which is difficult, which puts lots of providers under stress. So then again, going back to how long it takes to get an appointment in rural Minnesota. In fact, I'm just going to go off my tangent today, but we had a suicide in our community a couple months ago. And in this week's paper, our local paper talked about the family spoke out about finding services for their daughter and how it in rural Minnesota it's very difficult, because then you maybe wait 2 months for that appointment with the provider, and perhaps that 16 or 17 year old is not clicking with that provider, so they want to try to find another provider, and then we wait another 2-3 more months to get in. So by this time we're talking half a year. I started working my career mostly in corrections, which then geared me more towards mental health. But lots of conversations with corrections folks are echoing the same thing. This is becoming an overwhelming problem, because even in juvenile lockup facilities, they are corrections-based programs. They're not mental health providers. They're not equipped to deal with the needs that come through their door. The jails will tell you the same thing. I think we heard statistics today where most mental health issues are being seen more in the jails. The coaching design that we're talking about today is a good response to the needs within rural Minnesota. Our needs are growing, and we need to find a delivery system that works more in a rural area. We're really set up for providing mental health services, but it just doesn't fit. I know oftentimes we're set up and we're very comfortable in our community to respond to a problem and try to fix it, but that comes a little too late. The World Health Organization estimates that by 2030, depression will be the leading cause of disability in our high-income countries, which I would tend to probably agree with. We try to fix them. We don't have adequate resources to respond, especially in rural Minnesota, because of the issues that I had already talked about. But we can see in healthcare that we've made the connection with prevention. We talk about diabetes, heart disease, smoking, and prevention and early intervention are the key. I realize that the rate of return on investment isn't always so clear-cut in mental health, and I think that was brought up again today too. Probably because it's difficult to measure, because you see it across so many different areas. You see prevention in mental health, the return on investment in education, you see it in healthcare, you see it in the criminal justice system, you see it in social services and employment. As Ms. Ramos said, her son was a tax-paying citizen. That is a return on investment, because when folks aren't able to work and to function, they aren't employed. So we need to put our dollars into prevention. We need to put more into rural demonstration projects. This is what we're asking for today. I realize that is kind of a change in thinking sometimes, but we need a shift.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it sounds like a good model that's working well in your community, and this was amended to be just one-time only money. And one of the things I really encourage you to explore further is if there's any possibility of accessing the K-12 transition funding that's available for 18 to 21-year-olds. I know of someone with Asperger's in the metro area who is many of the things that your son experienced is getting those through the school system and those dollars. And now with the Olmstead settlement, I think vocational rehab is really stepping up to create better past employment. And so maybe the project can be enlarged to start exploring some of those other partnerships so it's sustainable over the long term, because it sounds like you're getting good results.
Thank you. Other questions? Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Baker, final thoughts.
Please support the bill. Thank you.
House Bill 1177 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Baker and testifiers. Next up, we have Representative Peterson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Peterson. I'll move House File 1371. And recommend it be referred to the General Register. Representative Peterson, the bill is before us. Your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a simple bill that will simply save lives. It provides for the addition of 21 child and adolescent psychiatric beds at the Brooklyn Park location of Prairie Care. As you may know, there is a website that you can check to see what beds are available, and there are no beds available anywhere in Minnesota for children needing admission to a psych unit. In fact, Prairie Care turns away 5 kids a day. There is no opposition to this proposal, and it's quite the contrary. There is quite a bit of support, and there is a fiscal note in your packet, which is zero, because these children are already being treated in other areas. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I ask your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Peterson. There are questions for Representative Peterson and House File 1371. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1371? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1371 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 1371 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Next up will be House File 1194 from Representative Albright. Representative Albright moves House File 1194 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. I see no amendments in the packet. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1194 is a bill that works to support children receiving residential mental health treatment. Since 2001, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have allowed Minnesota to receive federal Medicaid matching funds on residential mental health treatment for children in MA. CMS is now requiring Minnesota to designate each of these treatment programs with over 16 beds as IMDs, which stands for Institutions for Mental Disease. Programs that are determined to be IMDs will no longer be eligible for federal Medicaid funding. CMS has given the Department of Human Services until January 2018 to complete its review of all children's residential mental health treatment programs in the state, which there are about 700 children's residential treatment beds that are in jeopardy of losing federal funding as a result of this change. Minnesota has a program in place that pays for MA-covered services for individuals when they are in an IMD using state-only funds. However, children's residential treatment services are not eligible to utilize this funding stream under current state law. Without a change to allow medical assistance to make up for the loss of federal funding for residential mental health treatment, counties would bear 100% of the cost for children on fee-for-service MA and
there would be no mechanism to pay for services for children who receive MA through managed care. This bill appropriates state funding to cover the loss of federal funding and provides a small appropriation to conduct an analysis of the continuum of care for children in Minnesota to ensure we have the right services and the right funding mechanisms in place to keep children in their communities and their families when possible. I have testifiers, Mr. Chair, to answer any questions on the bill should they be necessary. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albright and testifiers. We have questions for Representative Albright and House File 1194. Would you like to offer something, sir? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity. My name is Richard Wilreet. I'm here representing two entities today. One, I'm the president and CEO of Northwood Children's Services in Duluth, Minnesota. Northwood's been around. We're a not-for-profit organization. We've been around since 1883. Providing mental health services to kids. We operate a full array of services from outpatient mental health, day treatment, foster care, residential treatment, and also operate corporate foster care programs. We currently serve 108 children in the residential treatment beds that the representative referenced in his reading of the proposed bill. I'm also representing Aspire Minnesota, which is our state association of intensive mental health providers. We have about 40 members representing about 500 programs and scattered throughout the state to provide that full array of mental health treatment services to kids. Residential treatment is a very intensive model. It's 24 hours a day. It's 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Kids are served in residential treatment for whom other attempts at resolving the mental health issues that they have been unsuccessful. At Northwood, the children we serve have had on 8 placements out of their home prior to being referred and treated by us, psychiatric hospitalizations, perhaps some corrections, foster care kinds of programs. Our job, basically, is to provide a highly structured and intense living and learning environment and teach the kids the coping skills, socialization skills, behavior management skills, emotional regulation, so that they can go home and be successful living in their home communities with their families and also be successful in their school environments. All of the children we serve in residential treatment have a mental health diagnosis. All have a statement of medical necessity from a mental health professional that level of care is required to address their needs. It's a critical level of care. It's something that access is absolutely crucial to maintain. I want to tell you a quick story about one of the students I ran into just before leaving and what we've been able to do in the residential treatment program at Northwood for this young man. He came here several years ago from the metro area, and as he would say, his mom made a number of bad decisions about what she did with her life and the people that she was associated with, and so parental rights were terminated. You can imagine the trauma, the grief, the loss that this young man had. He had already been placed in a number of foster care placements that weren't able to meet his needs. Came to us, and he was intensely and frequently aggressive. The relative and lawyer prepared him twice to be to be placed in adoptive families. Unfortunately, his inability to trust and really formulate meaningful relationships, neither one of those situations worked out. Of course, we were there to pick up the pieces each time. A turning point in this young man's life came just last year. His therapist had begun a running program with a number of the students. A runner himself, and he noticed in terms of just the ability to sort of prioritize, make decisions, use better judgment, and the emotional regulation that it brought about was really exceptional. And this young man benefited greatly from that, to the point that last year he got a lot of notoriety. He was the youngest runner and the youngest person to complete the grandma's half marathon. You can't register and participate unless you're at least 12 years old. So a number of the local media stations picked up on that, and of course that was a huge boost to his self-esteem. He was featured in a number of TV stories and interviewed, and newspaper did a nice article about him. Interestingly, the way media goes these days, the story was also picked up by a national publication, Runner's World. And they came out and did a three-page spread. Now I said, Marcellus, I'm surprised you even talked to me anymore. You're such a big shot. I have all these places that are interested in you. But huge boost to his self-esteem. I even got a letter from the coach of the U.S. cross-country ski team. Was so impressed by what we were doing in terms of the impact of the running program for that young man. Several others that they sent us a donation of $2,000 worth of running shoes. Marcellus is now, next week, scheduled to move into a foster home. I'm in Royal Duluth. He's happy. He's visited up there. There's a couple of other kids, that former Northwood residents, that are also placed at that home. He's a little nervous about it, but he's excited to go. We're always around to sort of support him through other kind of programmatic efforts that we have. And we were able to make an incredibly dramatic turnaround in this young man's life. Please support. I urge you, to support efforts to continue to have access to those services for children who are in need of that level of care. Thank you very much again for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Bolliott. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jamie Halpern. I'm an area manager in Hennepin County's Human Services and Public Health Department. And I'm testifying today on behalf of Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. MACSA strongly supports this legislation. The bill provides critical bridge and funding to sustain the fragile system of mental health services for Minnesota's children with mental health needs. The bill will also help Minnesota create a longer-term plan for the development of a stronger continuum of intensive mental health services and will establish recommendations for a sustainable and community-driven system of care for children and youth with serious mental health problems. Residential treatment programs are a critical component of Minnesota's mental health system for children and youth whose mental health conditions and behaviors require intensive 24-hour care and treatment. It is a necessary service used by all of Minnesota's counties. Without this legislation, the classification of Minnesota's residential treatment programs as IMDs will result in a new unfunded fiscal obligation for Minnesota's counties and its taxpayers, as the loss of federal Medicaid reimbursement will need to be replaced with local property tax funding. As most of you know, the child protection reforms in 2015 have been costly, and although the legislature provided significant funding to enact these reforms, it is estimated that the total annual cost of these reforms to counties in excess of the new state funding will total between $20 to $30 million annually. These costs, together with the pending loss of federal Medicaid reimbursement for Minnesota's residential treatment programs, could likely result in the elimination of essential programs and services for our state's children. On behalf of Minnesota counties, I urge you to support this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Halpern. Is there anyone else from the audience who'd like to testify on behalf of this bill? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Abbey-Holden. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abbey-Holden from NAMI, Minnesota. I'll be very brief. I do want to mention that Aspire Minnesota and NAMI worked with the entire congressional delegation, bipartisan effort, to try to get CMS to change their mind, and they did not. You've already heard today about how we need more hospital beds. If we lose 700 children's residential treatment beds, our entire children's mental health system will collapse. We know the counties are not going to pick up this entire cost, and so we really need to do something to keep what we have in place for these children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abbey-Holden. Anyone else who'd like to testify? Representative Gruenhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to one of the testifiers, why did CMS decide not to provide that funding anymore?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, Mary Regan, Aspire, Minnesota. It's actually a little bit confusing because they did approve the way we do this in 2001, but apparently have reconsidered and looked at the way we operate and have decided that according to the rules that they have to follow from the Social Security Act, that we are institutions for mental disease.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, is there anything we can do to correct that? I mean, are they funding it in other states and they just decided not to fund us, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, again, that's a little confusing. CMS operates in regions, and different regions interpret the same federal laws differently. But all we have to do, or all we can do, is deal with our region, and this is what our region is telling us. We attempted to ask the Secretary to consider doing this differently, and that's what Sue Abdaholden referenced with the Minnesota delegation, but they declined to make any changes.
All right. Representative Albright, final thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 1194 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Albright moves House File 1195 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. There are no amendments. Representative Albright,
to your bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, House File 1195 is the PRTF rate-setting bill. In 2015, the legislature approved Children's Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility Services as a new MA benefit to be fully implemented by July 1st of 2018. PRTFs are intended to serve children who require a more intensive level of care due to serious and complex mental health needs and other conditions. These needs and conditions include highly aggressive or self-harming behaviors, mental health diagnoses, neurodevelopment disorders, psychosis, and or other health conditions. The first of these PRTF beds are expected to be available in July of 2017 and will enroll providers to create capacity for 150 beds statewide at up to six sites. This bill establishes a rate-setting process for PRTFs in compliance with federal requirements. Specifically, this bill, under Section 1, clarifies that DHS can use available grant funding to help new PRTF programs with startup costs. The 2015 legislature appropriated money for this purpose, and no new money is being requested. Sections 2 through 4 outlines how payment rates are set for the new service and establishes admission and discharge criteria. This is something the legislature also directed DHS to develop as part of the 2015 legislation. Mr. Chair, that is the contents included in 1195. There is no opposition to the bill. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Are there questions for Representative Albright on House File 1195? Seeing none, is anyone from the audience want to testify on 1195? Seeing none, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 1195 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 1195 is re-referred. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much.
Next up, we have House File 1282, Representative Keel. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1282 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. There are no amendments in the packet. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1282 is a Psychology Practice Act update. This bill will provide greater access to qualified psychologists at a time when there is a shortage of high-quality mental health providers. With no charge to, with no change to the scope of practice, the bill will address some challenges that have arisen around the specifications for licensure for academic psychologists and supervision requirements for the individuals pursuing a postdoctoral psychological employment. With me is my testifier, and I will let her take over.
All right, Representative Keel, we have Dr. Robin McLeod. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Robin McLeod. I'm a licensed psychologist in Minnesota, and I'm speaking to you today in my role as the immediate past president of the Minnesota Psychological Association. I continue to serve our association by sitting on the executive committee, and our current president-elect and another past president of our professional association also are here today. House File 1282 is an update to the Minnesota Psychology Practice Act. It will provide greater access to qualified psychologists at a time, as you all know, when there is a severe workforce shortage for qualified mental health providers in Minnesota. And this legislation does this with no change to our scope of practice as psychologists. Early in 2016, prominent and well-respected psychologists in Minnesota began talking with the leadership of the Minnesota Psychological Association about surprising challenges they were facing regarding language in the Psychology Practice Act, specifying licensure for academic psychologists, and indicating confusion over supervision requirements for individuals who were pursuing their postdoctoral psychological employment. In order to address those challenges and concerns, the leadership of the Minnesota Psychological Association began meeting with psychologist stakeholders from both academic and practice settings to develop revisions in statutory language that would solve these newfound ambiguities. So this bill, in addition to simply removing outdated language, does the following. It clarifies the requirements for licensure for individuals holding academic positions in our institutions of higher education, those who teach psychology and conduct psychological research. It further specifies and clarifies postdoctoral supervision requirements. It changes the requirements for the volunteer license in order to increase the likelihood that psychologists will pursue this opportunity and make more professionals available for community and supervision activities in behavioral health. It adds an inactive license status for individuals contemplating retirement or those who move to another state, something that is similarly provided for in Minnesota licensing statutes for social work and by the Board of Medical Practice. This bill also eases the requirements for licensure by reciprocity, so that psychologists licensed in another jurisdiction can be more easily and quickly licensed when coming to Minnesota. It specifies training regarding statutory requirements for supervisors to ensure that they are meeting current requirements of statute and rule. And finally, it moves fees for various board activities to statute from rule, such that the fees will have greater oversight by the legislature. By voting to accept these revisions to the Minnesota Psychology Practice Act that are being proposed in House File 1282, you and your colleagues will be resolving concerns raised by prominent psychologists in practice and academic settings. You will be clearing the way to bring more highly qualified psychologists into the mental health care workforce in Minnesota. You will be increasing access to quality behavioral health care for the citizens of Minnesota. And you will be doing all of this with the consensus of psychologist stakeholders in practice, academic, and regulatory settings at a minimal financial burden to the state of Minnesota, because fees levied against only psychologists are built into the legislative revisions. Psychologists want these changes and will be the payers for the changes. I hope you'll please support this legislation.
Thank you, Dr. McLeod. Anyone in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? Anyone in the audience? Seeing none, member questions for either the testifier or the author of the bill. Seeing none, Representative Keel, you have the last word.
Good bill. Please vote for it.
With that, House File 1282 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Keel, I'll move House File 262 also to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We now have the bill before us. I understand there is an A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 amendment focuses on the scope of the working group duties for dementia issues only. It will clarify some of the duties, clarify the board that the Board on Aging will convene the first meeting and name the chair. Limit the number of meetings to 5, clarifying the expense reimbursement language to include the $55 per diem that allows some limited expense reimbursement, specifies the funding is one time that can be used through the time, the report that is finalized in 2019. House File 262 creates a new working group to review and revise the 2011 report on preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's and to submit new recommendations for the legislature. Because this bill has been heard in several committees already, I want to focus my comments on the finance committee.
There are 91,000 people living in Alzheimer's with Alzheimer's in Minnesota. There are nearly a quarter of a million people in our state providing unpaid care for friends and family living with the disease. My family is one of those. I've witnessed firsthand the impacts of this disease. It is critical that we manage the impacts of Alzheimer's and dementia in our families, our communities, and our budgets. New data is released just this week that estimates that in 2017, Minnesota's Medicaid costs for caring for people with Alzheimer's will be $781 million. That number is expected to increase to over $1 billion by 2025. Since this bill was heard in HHS policy, we have adjusted the appointment schedule and extended the time frame to work to the work group to more closely align with the Board of Aging work schedule. We've also made this a one-time working group, not an ongoing effort. In order to minimize the impacts of this disease on our state budget, this work group will make recommendations to improve public awareness and information available on the disease to reduce risk and prevent unavoidable hospitalizations, to improve diagnosis and treatment, and to adequately train and direct the direct care workers and the licensed mental health professionals. With me today, I have two people here to testify to in support of this bill. Ms. McMullen.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. McMullen. If you could state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota and North Dakota chapter. You have a one-page handout with some additional statistics on Alzheimer's in Minnesota. And because this bill has been heard, and I know a number of you have already heard my testimony, I won't repeat that, but I'm here to answer any questions. But we would like one of our advocates to testify today as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, my name is Eric Lynn. I'm the oldest son of five boys in our family. Our mother, Irene Lynn, suffers from Alzheimer's and its crippling effects. I'm here to testify in support of House File 262. Thank you for your time today. Our story has been nothing short of a nightmare. The bill before you today will help families like ours dealing with this disease. Irene is the mother of five sons, four daughter-in-laws, and seven grandchildren. Irene was a caregiver herself, working as a nurse's aide for over 20 years. Oftentimes taking us boys to visit the residents she cared for, some of which became like grandparents to us. Today, our mother, Irene, resides in a memory care unit in the same facility she worked in all those years. Alzheimer's was a devastating blow. We had no idea at the time just how devastating it would be or the challenges that lied ahead. As young boys, we lost our father, Ron, to a farm accident at the age of 42. Somehow, our mother persevered through it all, never putting her own pain or well-being first. Mom raised us, kept our small farm going, and worked full-time, never missing school events or activities. After diagnosis in 2009, at the age of 59, she soon lost her job, her privileges to drive, her home, her dog, and her livelihood. We became caregivers, not sure who to turn to, searching for answers, often in denial ourselves. Alzheimer's is very complicated, and the challenges can be very overwhelming. It seems every time the disease reared its head, we were kicked down the road. Mom is currently in her third care facility. Our family is at her side daily to help with meals, bathing, one-on-ones, common needs that even the facility struggles to provide adequately. As a young family, it's been very difficult, to say the least. So many unknowns in search of answers, looking for direction to make the best decisions possible. As soon as you think you have it figured out, or you're on track, the wheels fall off and it all falls apart. For families that are just being diagnosed today or have a loved one living with Alzheimer's already, they are in search of help and need of direction, oftentimes living in crisis mode, not knowing who they can trust or what they should do next, praying for a cure. Early detection, public awareness will help families prepare early for many of the challenges that lie ahead, doctoring, financial, personal, and family. Identifying caregivers and offering support, education, a day off will benefit all involved. We have professionals, caregivers from doctors to PCAs that do not understand the stages of the disease and its progression. They cannot assure families that they are competent to advise or care for our loved ones or family. A kick-the-can solution to a hopeless fight, compounding the suffering. My mom is still Irene Lynn. Irene's still a mother to Eric, Steve, Phil, Sam, Mike. Irene is still a grandmother to Spencer, Callie, Hayden, Hudson, Kale, Briella, and Aaron. This is my mom. She's just as important as all your mothers, and this is all we have left. Please help us fight this disease. I just wanted to urge you for this House file support. Our family was also featured on Care 11, Land of 10,000 Stories, and it's kind of a story about a tribute to my mom and dad, but also woven in there is how important it is to keep families together to fight this disease because it really can tear you apart. So thank you for your support today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Lynn. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? Seeing none, member questions for either the author or the testifiers. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. A few years ago, I went through the Alzheimer's issue with a family member. It is devastating. When you have that family member you've known for years, you go to see them, and they have no clue who you are and start yelling at you to get out of there. That was very rough for my wife and her family. And now, last October, I'm going to find out I'll be dealing with that with my mother. So I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Keel, you have the final word.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As Representative Johnson pointed out, it touches everyone. And it is very devastating and challenging. And I think the frustrating part is we can't. We have no way to stop it yet. We're learning how to handle it. We're learning how to work with family members. But it is tough. It is a sad and challenging issue. Some of the great work that we did already came out of the 2011 recommendations. But we need to keep moving forward. Tracking progress and examining the impact is important. This bill will help bring us together with the necessary stakeholders and to determine the next steps that Minnesota needs to address with Alzheimer's. I ask you to please support the motion.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon. House File 262, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zerwas, we have House File 345 before us. I see no amendments. I will move House File 345 before us. It will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. To you, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 345 is the palliative care bill. Palliative care is treating the symptoms of a serious disease at any stage to improve the quality of life. There's a misconception that palliative care is synonymous with end-of-life or hospice care. While palliative care includes care at the end of life, it should also be a part of all curative treatment plans for serious and chronic diseases to help treat those symptoms and improve the patient quality of life. Better access to palliative care will help manage many of the concerns that cause patients and families to really worry and wonder about how their end of life might be treated. I'm happy to say we've seen a broad coalition come together in support of improving access to palliative care, and I'm excited to focus on improving this and including it in the mainstream of healthcare options provided to families as they deal with serious and chronic illnesses. I do have a testifier today, Ms. Ellie Beaver from the Minnesota Cancer Action Network from the American Cancer Society.
Ms. Beaver, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, and then we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Albright, members of the committee. I'm Ellie Beaver. I'm the Government Relations Director here in Minnesota for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Many of you have heard from me
already and have heard stories from our volunteers about why palliative care is so important, so I will be brief. Palliative care is care that can be provided alongside curative treatment. This is important to the Cancer Society because nearly two-thirds of people who are diagnosed with cancer are surviving more than 5 years, and there are nearly 15 million cancer survivors in the United States. Improving palliative care is a priority for us, as many more Minnesotans who are diagnosed with cancer are surviving that diagnosis and living long past it. We need to ensure that those survivors have the highest quality of life possible. As Representative Zervas talked about, palliative care addresses the symptoms of treatment and disease so survivors can continue to do the things they need to do, such as work and take care of their family, and what they love to do and what make life worth living, like playing with their kids or grandkids, dancing at a wedding, going on a family vacation, or continuing on a beloved hobby. Palliative care addresses symptoms like pain and nausea, and it can also include things like physical therapy to regain mobility, massage to reduce the swelling from lymphedema, and support to families reeling from a cancer diagnosis. While palliative care is essential to high-quality cancer care, cancer patients aren't the only ones who benefit from palliative care. It's for anyone diagnosed with a serious or chronic disease and is appropriate at any age and any stage of illness and can be provided alongside curative treatment. Establishing a committee that can evaluate the palliative care system in Minnesota and make policy recommendations to the legislature on how to improve it will help all patients with serious or chronic conditions and their families get the care and support that they need. I just also wanted to say that in addition to this being a professional issue, it's also a personal issue for me. I'm a cancer survivor myself, and palliative care helped me during my treatment almost 35 years ago with the pain and nausea that was associated with that treatment. So, as Representative Zervas pointed out, often we associate it with end-of-life care, but here I am 35 years later having survived my diagnosis, and part of the reason I'm helping well today is because of that palliative care that was provided during my treatment. So I encourage you to support Hospital 345, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify to the bill? Seeing no one, we'll go to member questions. Member Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does sound a lot like hospice and what my mother went through, so is it basically the only difference is duration, or it's just not end of life? I'm just a little unclear as to what the differences are.
Ms. Bieber.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Considine. Palliative care, I like to think of it as an umbrella, and hospice is one piece under that umbrella. But palliative care can include many different types of supportive care. So hospice is always palliative care, but not all palliative care is hospice, if that helps.
Follow up.
No, it does. Thank you. That's actually pretty good.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Zervas, you have the final word on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. This is a great bill, and I think it would be a huge benefit to the state to provide the committee to help ensure that we're providing this type of service and support as we treat our family members that are going through chronic and serious diseases. With that, if you want to renew your motion.
Representative, I will renew my motion to place House File 345 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Members, next week is going to be a very busy one for this committee. We are on track to be hearing scores of bills. With that being said, we will be having at least two evening hearings, probably on Wednesday and Thursday. That being said, we're adjourned.